It's Friday, April 26, 2013, and you're listening to episode 297 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 11 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
My name's Chad.
And this is Chris.
Fear the Con 6 coming up here very shortly. If you are coming to the convention, be sure to get online and do two things. First of all, sign up both to run and play in games. If you are not running a game, then I want to hear your excuse because my 68-year-old father, who is not a gamer, is running a game. What's your excuse for being a little bitch? I want to hear it.
That's true.
Is he really running a game?
Yes. My 68-year-old father is running a game.
What Chris, game is he running?
I'd have to check to be sure, but I believe he is running a board game session. Mm-hmm. And I think that he's going to focus, because he's a really big train buff, he's going to focus on train games.
Oh, very cool.
I'll have to check to be sure, because I don't remember. He told me, I just don't recall top of my head what it was. But my point being, if he can do it, whatever your excuse is, it's probably not really convincing.
Absolutely. That's amazing. That's awesome, man. I think that's fantastic.
The other thing is, don't forget to get out there and get your ticket purchased, because one of the things that we like to do every year is get those name badges handed out at the wing night, and that does two things. First off, that lets people know who you are and helps you know who other people are. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, that also saves any kind of a rush or delay with trying to get people through a line on Friday morning. And so anyone that's prepaid, we try to catch up with them at the wing night and get them their badge immediately and get a lot of the folks taken care of. So if at all possible, please be sure to get out there and get your ticket purchased ahead of time.
Yeah, it will make that Friday morning so much easier.
For all parties involved. All right, Chris.
Yes.
You're up. You had a topic you want to talk about. Asia?
Well, you said Europe.
Okay. All right.
The collective groan sounded really good on this end.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that that makes it into the episode, so I'm going to say go ahead and delete that, because the fastest way on any podcast to make sure something makes it is to say, we'll cut that.
Yeah, it's not going to make the cut. But yes, go on. Wayne had mentioned something.
Yeah, in the last episode, we were interviewing Mark Dina, who is working on Shadowrun 5th edition, and he mentioned that there is a writing credit you've got, or a playtest credit, or something to that effect, I don't recall exactly, in a Shadowrun book.
Yes.
And he even said at the time what book that was, and I don't off the top of my head recall what book it was, to be completely honest. I want to say it was like, I don't even know what. It was a book about space hamsters or something. All right. But that
sounds like Shadowrun to me.
Do you remember what that book was?
Well, I have several, actually, so it could have been any number of them. I contributed to an adventure anthology. I contributed to Dunkelzahn's Will. I contributed to a couple of the source books. So it could have been one of many. I have far less Shadowrun credits than I do Battletech credits. I'd say there's probably a handful of books I did for Shadowrun or helped with.
I think I'm jealous of Chris now. He just went on
solo
about
projects.
He just went on and named like five or six credits he has in Shadowrun to follow up with, but I don't have nearly as many credits as I do with Battletech. Yeah.
I mean, Chris was not quite on the level of somebody like Weissman or whatnot, but no, Chris did quite a bit of work with Battletech.
I finally understand why you and Tex hated him.
Well, yeah, for one simple reason.
Nemesis?
Yeah, he was
Chris was your nemesis.
He was our nemesis. He was our adversary. Hmm. Chris was unwittingly our eternal cock block. Because
I went back and I MechForce North America stalked you after we had various discussions. I went back and dug out my old issues and looked at some of the stuff that you and Tex did.
Yeah, Cassie Blake. If you look in the 20-year update, Cassie Blake was our character.
Sassy Cassie?
Now, we did not name her Sassy Cassie. That part was not our doing.
No.
But it's kind of interesting. It was two brothers writing this, but they said they wanted it kind of more of a female presence or persona in Battletech. So they asked us to write all these articles, which were on board game strategy, you know, how to play and win at Battletech using different weight classes of mechs and all that kind of stuff. And then each one would have a scenario that would sort of illustrate the concepts that we just talked. So if it was like using the maneuverability of light mechs, then there'd be a scenario where you only win by using the maneuverability of light mechs. And they asked us to write it from the perspective of a House Marik. I think she was a general by the name of Cassandra Blake. And so they kind of gave us that character, and she's in the 20-year update. But every time we made a move to take a step up to, you know, move away from Mechnorth Force in America, there was fucking Chris Hussey every single time. It's like, oh, you guys can do this project. Oh, we just gave it to Chris Hussey. Oh, we'll let you in on some fiction over here. Oh, you know, we just gave it to Chris Hussey.
Damn right.
You know, I freaking... I can't tell you how much time we spent cursing your name during our adolescence and early 20s. And it's funny because this only changes then when some years later, this guy gets on our forums and starts mentioning that he used to write for FASA. And I'm, of course, intrigued. Like, oh, well, who are you? Oh, I'm Chris Hussey. You motherfucker. You even follow me over here? What, someday you're going to host my podcast or something?
It kind of plays into the whole thing when we first actually did get to know each other and you invited me down to your place.
To
I remember
kill you.
For that very first, well, see, that was the thing, is that I thought, I know, as I'm driving down there, I'm going to meet this group of guys who I really actually have no idea who they really are. I've only listened to them for maybe about 20 episodes, and I only know them through, you know, private messages and the podcast, which is, you know, you guys are completely not like this on the mics at all. And when you're away from the mics. And so I'm thinking as I'm driving down there, I might not be coming back from this. And, yeah, well, you know, and it was a cold January day, and this would be a perfect time to find my, you know, bloated, frozen carcass on the side of the road somewhere.
That's the thing, Chris, is I got to say that once I got to know you, and once I came to find out two things, one, that what occurred was really fastest poor organizational skills. I mean, I don't want to start throwing around names, but there were certain individuals who just weren't doing a good job of tracking and passing out the work. And then second, they also came to find out that apparently it was a different Chris who actually cock-blocked us on our biggest opportunity. It wasn't you.
Oh, Chris Hartford.
Yeah, Chris Hartford.
Yeah, he cock-blocked me a couple times, too.
You know, and I got to know you, and it turned out you were a really incredible guy. You're a great person. You're, I think, a gifted writer. And once all those emotions were out of the way, my view of you changed radically. There's a story that you were telling us when we were starting to record that I have actually never heard before. This was brought up during our kind of brief mention of Mark Dina saying that he recalls you from your work on Shadowrun. So take it away from here.
Basically, what happened was, you know, my first actual FASA product was back in 93, and then I kind of continued to contribute, and, you know, my own stocks was kind of on the rise as far as a lot of that stuff went. And then I started to branch out into Shadowrun a little bit, because I played that game as well, so I was familiar with the universe and was, you know, confident enough in that game that I could go ahead and do some things. Well, what happened was I was contributing to another adventure anthology, and the adventure did finally make it in there, and I think it was either, I think the final name of the adventure was called, like, A Pitcher's Worth. The original title was called Run, and there was a reason for that. But anyway, I wrote the adventure, sent it out. If I got the title wrong, it has to do with the adventure about photographs from the surface of Mars and evidence that there was more there than what was originally taken. So if you happen to know the name of that title and I don't, then by all means, please post in the forums. Anyway, so what ended up happening, I submitted it there, and I kind of just sat and waited to hear the standard feedback, is I'd already signed the contract and all was good to go. Well, I actually got a phone call from the Shadowrun line developer at that time, Mike Mulvihill, and he was very hesitant on the phone. He said he wanted to talk to me rather than just send me an email, because, you know, he liked me, he knew who I was, and, you know, and he kind of felt that a phone call was better. Then there was that long, kind of like awkward pause, and he says, basically it kind of comes down to, completely paraphrasing here, but your submission sucks, and sucks really bad. He kind of went on to explain a lot of the reasons why their plot was incredibly linear and railroady. A lot of it didn't make sense. There was no real motivation for the PCs to do what they were doing. There was unnecessary double-crossing going on. It was a mess all around. It was an awful piece. But he was, like, you know, couching it in much nicer terms than that. And he says, I wanted to do you a favor, you know, as a writer. I want to send you the editorial notes. And he said, normally we don't do this kind of stuff. You know, usually the editor takes a look at it, then the line developer fixes it, and the actual writer never sees these notes because they're more internal and honest. You know, basically, he sent me the notes, and he's like, you know, read these and then really think about it. And then by all means, you know, rework it and submit it. So I got the notes, and I think I'd had a particularly bad day at work. And so this did not help that day at all, actually. And it, basically everything he said was in these person's notes, but they were even far more brutal towards me and my writing than Mike was at the time. Mike was trying to be kind and cushion the blow a little bit, but it was, I can't even describe how brutal it was. And it turned out to be a very bad thing at the time, because I did go and try to rework it as best I could, and it still was not, in the end, up to snuff to what they wanted to. And then so somebody else actually had to take it over and fix it. I just could not fix my own work. It's probably one of the worst things I had ever written.
Now, when you say you couldn't fix your own work, you mean because it was that far gone, or because kicked in the nuts, you had just lost?
It was definitely the nut kicking that was a part of it. Then you feel kind of almost a tremendous pressure to really do a good job. But so it was partially that, but then at the same time, it was also the fact that I think I was very, very stuck on certain things that I was unwilling to give up. I put too much emotional attachment to a lot of aspects of the plot that I wasn't willing to sacrifice and give up to make the story actually better. I couldn't quite fix it, so it had to be fixed by somebody else in the end. I think I got like a based on an idea from credit in the end product. But what ended up happening I know. It's like here's your writing attaboy. But what had happened from that is my skin was not that thick that time as far as that goes, because, I mean, I really, those kind of hit me to the core, and that kind of prompted me to basically just kind of fall out of doing a lot of any sort of writing for gaming for about 4 years, basically. But the good thing that actually ended up happening on all this was I realized later on that the editor, whoever looked at it, was 100% correct. As I went back and reread the original manuscript and everything, I realized that every single point that he made was absolutely true. It is a piece of garbage as far as an adventure goes. And
you're running this adventure at Fear the Con, right?
I am going to run this adventure at Fear the Con as written.
Original.
Totally.
I do have the original. I kept a file of my original. I should actually drag that sucker out and then and run that piece of shit. I'd have to dig up my. I think I'd have to do second edition.
I'd play
rules,
that.
I say, is it wrong that I want to play this?
Everyone plays a ginger bard elf.
Hell yeah. There we go. Yeah.
You could do that as an after-hours game. I bet there's a lot of people who would want to play this, because I know I do. And not just to call you a terrible writer and a horrible old man, because I do that anyway.
But it doesn't stop you.
Here's the funny thing. If you took a good game and threw it in front of chat and said, hey, I'd like to run this for you, and you give this really excellent explanation about the Shadowrun game you want to run, he wouldn't be interested. But you tell him, I've got this piece of shit. And now he's hooked.
I'm really curious, because there's a part of me thinking it cannot possibly be that bad.
If we ever revisit the pitch idea of pitching games, we need to throw in
Earthshaker with the communist gnomes.
Dude, that's brilliant.
Made it out the door. I can't imagine what doesn't make it out the door. But, Chris, here's my question for you, where I want to tie this back from a personal anecdote to, I guess, something of a bit of RPG advice. You said that getting that kind of feedback sort of knocked you off the horse for a few years in terms of your writing before you came back. But I'm curious, what was the distinction, if any, between writing an adventure for your buddies to play versus writing a module for publication? I mean, obviously, there's got to be some difference, because you as a game master are not there to roll with the changes. You have to presuppose some things. So I'm curious, what in terms of a process is the difference between writing a module and writing a game that you're actually going to run?
For me, the difference is it's a character familiarity. You know, in any adventure that I've ever written, for whether it was for Living Greyhawk or whether it was for Shadowrun, and I even actually have written some MechWarrior RPG adventures, one of them which made into MechForce North America. But the difference, is the character familiarity, because I can, for my own group, I can write an adventure and I can have NPC appearances that are tied to a specific character and tied to a specific maybe event that occurred in the past or event that needs to occur for that character's personal development. When you're doing a module for characters that you're never going to meet or know, it's very, very difficult to do that without being incredibly generic, you know, and just then providing notes for the GM saying, if a character has some sort of daddy issue, they get to meet this guy, which may or may not even matter in that adventure. So for me, it is a level of intimacy and familiarity.
That's actually what I was about to ask you, if you have to make it more generic. Not saying generic as a bad thing, but generic as not tailored to any group.
You do have to make it generic because in a module, it's basically impossible to even begin to try and figure out all the various angles that a player can take. All the best you can do is just offer some general advice. Say, if the characters go off on this particular track, this might happen. It's much easier to roll with those punches, I think, when you're familiar with characters in the world and the surroundings and, you know, what has happened in the past. But go ahead, your question.
Yeah, I've got a timeline question for you. So in terms of timeline, was Mars Mission Abortion written before or after Hotspots?
This was after.
All right. Yeah. Now I want to talk for a moment about Hotspots.
Hotspots was my first ever FOSSA project.
And actually, of all the things I'm aware of that you have contributed to, that is the one product of yours that even in our heyday, or I should say our hate day, that I owned and I still have sitting on the shelf to my left. And let me explain what Hotspots is for anyone that's not familiar with it. Hotspots is not a module in the typical sense of the word. Hotspots is a book full of game concepts. And this is something, by the way, that I wish more games would come with because of the fact that they give you a sense of what you can do in the world. They give you inspiration and ideas, but they are so vague that, one, it's not railroady, and two, even if everyone in the group owns and has read that book, they still have no idea where this is headed. All they know is the same stuff you would learn from a movie trailer. They know the setup. And that's what Hotspots is. It's a series of contracts and game concept ideas for a BattleTech Mercenaries game where you can pull something out of there. It says, hey, imagine if you went to a planet that was like this, or you ran into a group that wants you to do that. And here are some of the conflicts and concepts that can come up in this game. But it was very open-ended. It was not spelled out in terms of a you start here and end here sort of format that a module is. And I'm kind of curious, Chris, I mean, this is kind of weird in that we're interviewing one of our own hosts, but what was that writing process like? And why did you not attempt that with something like Shadowrun? Because, I mean, 90 some odd percent of people that play Shadowrun are probably playing Shadowrunners who are effectively mercenaries.
To answer your second question first, I guess the reason why I never attempted it for Shadowrun is because, honestly, I never thought about it. I never thought to do anything particular like that. Maybe there had been enough in the supplement books in regards to how they threw out loose ends or potential plot threads for characters to explore that maybe it may not have been necessary. As far as honestly going about it, you know, looking back at it now, to me, that was actually a very, very easy product to write because, as you mentioned, they're all like these, you know, multiple individual little things. So it's essentially like I'm writing 25, 1500 word blurbs and that's it. So I don't have to necessarily be 100% coherent and complete with everything I'm doing. So I can afford to just say, here's one thing, here's another thing. And they don't even have to be related. It's like eating a bag of chips as opposed to a whole meal. You can just take one at a time and eventually you can get through the whole thing a lot before you know it.
And then Mike Mulvihill calls here and eating a bag of shit.
But that, you know what, though, in the end, I appreciated that because it did. Once I finally came back, it made me have a far, far thicker skin.
So what changed? Because obviously you went back to writing. What was it that kind of helped you refine your confidence? Fairly straightforward to see what knocked you off the horse. What got you back on it?
It's just a lot of, you know, I don't want to get too deep on anybody here, but just a lot of internal reflection on things, you know, and you realize that, okay, that was like 4 years ago. Maybe you should stop whining and feeling bad for yourself and just go and try it again and see what happens. I had written enough, you know, stuff for my buddies that I could go back and try and adapt what I had done there to actual published product. And, you know, and when I met with some initial success, then it was very, very easy to kind of continue on.
I think part of the relevance of this to a broader RPG audience is not only to give a sense of what it is like to be on the other side of the RPG production line, because I think there's something, Chris, that we have with you that we don't have with most people that we interview, which is the fact that you can be
a 10,000 year view of history.
Yeah. I mean, it's got the long view of history.
I really take the long, I'm Truth Booth's own living elf.
But it's the fact that you can be candid with us in a way that I think even some of the most candid interview subjects we've had can't be. because one, the audience is familiar with you, and two, you're not on here because of any publication coming up or any company that you represent. And so you can really be honest about the human aspect of game creation. But here's the thing. Any group that plays a role-playing game has had a hand in creating role-playing games. Even if you are playing stuff straight out of the box or book, you are still coming up with your own characters, your own settings, your own plot points. You are still going to get a reaction from the people you run those games for. Sometimes it's easy to take, sometimes it's not. Talking about putting it in front of strangers, what's the difference between a con game and publication? I mean, obviously there's some degree of exposure difference there, but you're still kind of going up against the same thing of you're pitching an idea against a bunch of strangers with no idea how they're going to respond to it. And so I think, you know, even if we look at this and say, okay, most people are not in the position that you're in and very likely never have been and never will be. But nonetheless, I think there is some kind of an allegory to the story because of the fact that really what you went through, I think, is so similar to what we all go through with the process of creating games and putting yourself out there. I mean, that's what it is. You know, sure, it's easier with people you know, but there is still some sense of you're putting yourself out there and you don't want to hear at the end of the day that your baby's ugly.
Yeah. And well, it seems like every couple months we'll have someone new sign up to the forum and they'll share a story of how they ran their first game or they ran a game and everything just fell apart and it went bad. And then they have that same problem that you're talking about, Chris, having to rebuild up the confidence before they can come back. They're just afraid to put something else out there because of that.
I think in a lot of ways, con games are almost more nerve-wracking than, you know, sending something out to be published, because at least with trying to get published with something, you have the opportunity to make edits and to make it better. When you're in that con game, A, that feedback is immediate and direct. You have, you know, five people staring right back in your face, and you don't necessarily get a second chance unless you're going to run the event again, and then you have to hope that no word of mouth doesn't spread that, don't sign up for his game, it sucks, you know, so that you actually get that second chance to do it again.
This is something that I have to give some credit to Fear the Boot for. And I mean the experience of running the show. I don't necessarily mean the show itself, or in this case, necessarily even the community. I just mean the opportunity to do this show. I have really freaking thin skin. I'll admit it. I'll own that fact. While it's still not super thick, it's gotten a little bit thicker. And I have to give credit to people like Chad, who don't give a crap what anyone thinks, because it's funny. I noticed the other day in looking through our list of forum titles that several of them are insults that people have hurled either at the show, at the host, or at you guys, the listeners. I'm dead serious about this. Mm-hmm. Over the years that we have kind of owned and turned into running jokes. I'm looking at one here, 2,500 posts, myopic sycophant.
Yep.
That one was leveled at you guys. The one that's actually cracked me up the most is that the 33,500 post level is like the Lord Foul level of posts. The titles posts are 70% derisive diatribe and 30% poorly presented advice. By the way, this was the first negative review we got, except instead of posts, it said that our episodes had that makeup. But
now anyway, you're giving stuff away. I don't think anybody's gotten to that.
Yeah, somebody has. That's how I saw it.
Oh, did they?
That's how I saw it. I wasn't looking through the ranks when I noticed that. I saw somebody had that. I'm like, holy crap, that's hilarious.
All right. Yeah, I put a lot of Easter egg forum titles.
Yeah, and
in
I don't want to ruin them all, but no, somebody has earned that because I saw it. That's how I knew it was in there. And I looked at that for me, like, oh my gosh, I remember that. Back in like 2006 or whenever we got started, it was like within our first month or two. It was like our first negative review. Anyway, all right, here we sit now as kings of the internet.
New forum title.
King of the internet.
Yes.
Lord of our own tiny domain.
Oh, my God.
Lord Fell will definitely reach lord of our own tiny domain.
Someone seriously needs to... We have a forum title suggestion thread. Someone, anyone, post that in there, because as soon as we turn this off, I'll forget, but I'll see it if it's posted there and I'll add it.
All right. So let's talk RPG advice here beyond just kind of self-confidence and whatnot. There's a topic that I want to talk about that is occurring in our current game, but is certainly not restricted to our current game. I have seen this in many games I have both run and played in. And that topic is captivity. I mean the topic as simply as it sounds. The party gets captured.
Dan, I would like to share a story regarding this. The very first game I ever played in, your Skies of Glass game that you were running,
mm-hmm.
I still remember there was a session. I'm sure Chad and Pat will probably remember this as well. We were captured by the IST, and we spent...
Well, you guys are captured
by the IST. Chad's character wasn't, but everyone else was captured by the IST. And we spent one entire session as prisoners. Now, I remember as a new player, this was my first experience in role-playing at all, was that campaign.
With gaming, period. You had never gamed at all. This was your first session?
Oh my gosh. The first session, but it was the first campaign.
Oh, okay. And it wasn't that many sessions.
No, it was like two or three.
I remember, as a new player, I'm going through in my mind, like, well, I know Dan said he doesn't like to kill characters, so there's got to be a way out for this. Nobody seems to be doing much except for Chad, who's out there. There's got to be something that we're not catching on. I know Dan doesn't want to kill us, but if we don't do anything, our characters are going to be killed. And I actually, through the entire session, it was going through my mind, we need to be doing something. We've got to be trying something. I was looking for the give. It's like somewhere in here, there is a give that he has set up, and we just aren't doing anything to find it yet. And I spent that whole session trying everything and trying to talk to everyone, just searching for there's something that we're all overlooking.
I think captivity is something that actually can help your game in surprising ways if you know how to use it, but can also really, really screw up your game if you misuse it. And I think one of the first things that I want to throw out there, and I think it's necessary to lead off with this disclaimer, because there are a few things I want to mention here in the value of captivity that I think might make it tempting to engineer a situation of captivity in a game, which is why I want to start with the disclaimer. It needs to happen organically. To the best of my recollection, I don't think I have ever set up a game, certainly not within my more recent GMing career, where it was in my notes, the party is going to get captured. Now, that was always a possible outcome. I mean, it's no different than anything else. You go out in life and cause enough of a ruckus, the possibility is going to occur that you guys surrender, or the bad guys outnumber you, or depending on the game, the cops show up and arrest you. But something's going to happen where you guys end up in captivity. But I cannot recall ever having engineered a game where my goal was to get the party captured. And I think it is tempting for game masters to do it. One, because of the value that captivity can have, which one thing I'll come back to in a second. But secondly, because of the fact that it's an easy way to control the party. This is what I'm going to call the Azure Bonds syndrome. Now, in Azure Bonds, you really...
Which is a video game in a D&D module.
And I think there's a novel or something. Yeah, anyways. But the point being, if anyone's not familiar with the storyline, it's a Forgotten Realms storyline, where the party wakes up, they've been captured but don't remember the captivity, they've now been set free, their equipment is all gone, the party has effectively been reset, all you have is your character level, whatever that may be, and you have all over your body these tattoos, these Azure Bonds, that you have to go undo. And as long as they're on you, they control you and do bad things to you. And there's tasks you have to do.
Sounds like such an exciting game. Yeah. I did enjoy the video game.
Yeah, it sounds like it could be a really fun con game, a one shot. Yeah.
But here's the point, though. How does it start off? It starts off with you have no control over the situation. You don't know how it happened. You wake up one day and all your stuff is gone. The party is right on a leash. When you've lost control with your game, capture the party, strip them of their levels, strip them of their gear, do bad things to them, and they're right back where you want them to be. And I can't stand that. I think it is a bad idea to so inorganically force anything into a game. And captivity, I think, can be the most frustrating of them because of the fact that while you're in captivity, you are effectively just at somebody else's mercy. And if you can't even in your mind reconcile you did anything to trigger it, there's nothing you really can say that you did that plausibly led to this situation. It is unbelievably frustrating as a player. And I think it is a cheap shot for the GM.
I could only accept it if it were the beginning of the campaign.
Well, yeah, if it's at the very beginning of things, or, you know, if you're doing a slave lords kind of, startup, then maybe. But yeah, to just have it be something where the party hasn't had any control over the situation in regards to allowing that capture. Yeah, it's not fair. And it's almost, in a lot of sense, I think it's worse than railroading certain plot points down people's throats. You're sticking them into a situation that they couldn't have avoided. It's It's not fair.
Yeah, and I will agree with you. I think that if it is used to set up the game, maybe you can introduce a little bit inorganically because of the fact that it's the premise of the game. The premise of the game is you guys are all prisoners on a mining asteroid, or you're all prisoners in the dungeon somewhere. Baldur's Gate starts off this way.
Every Skyrim game, or every
Elder Scrolls game starts off this way. But I think there are games and situations where, yes, you can use that as a premise, but where I would have a problem with it is where it occurs midway through the game and is not something that occurred organically. Now, with that disclaimer put down, now let me start talking about the value that I think captivity can add to a game. Let's start off with the first one. It's a way of punishing the party or making them suffer a consequence, is perhaps a better phrase to use, without going to a TPK.
The key there is party, not player. I caught your words in there very carefully. You're doing this to the characters, not the players.
Right. And this is one of the things that I think leads to a lot of really weird situations in RPGs where it's not clear how to put fair consequences upon the party. Because, and who was it we were interviewing who said that one of the biggest problems with role-playing games is the fact that a clear message is never sent that it's okay to stop fighting. It's okay to surrender.
That's the biggest problem that I as a GM, have with enacting a capture scenario, is that in most traditional games, not like ones where it's, you know, Jane Eyre, the role-playing game or something like that. But in most games, you play... Pat is really excited about the Jane Eyre role-playing game.
That's awesome.
And the problem is that in most of these role-playing games, you play a combat god. I mean, unless it's like first level, you know, bullshit nothing game, you are a powerful entity regardless of what game you play, and your character is usually, at least in the mechanics, maybe not in a story and stuff, but in the mechanics and in what's going on, has a lot of combat ability. So when a certain level of violence occurs, like the cops come knocking on your door and say, okay, so we're taking you downtown, the first reaction is, well, I'm going to start pressing all the buttons on my character sheet.
Yeah, I've got this armor, I've got this gun, I've got these three grenades. Let's go.
Yeah, it's like, why? And people don't understand that the sort of Grand Theft Auto escalation happens from there of, okay, so the town watch comes and gets you and you kill them. And then the town militia comes out and comes to get you and you kill them. And the nearby fort sends some regular army soldiers to come get you and you kill them. And as a GM, you're just sitting there like, this is really spun out of control, because I just wanted them to get thrown in the dungeon for the night so that they can get the MacGuffin from the guy and do this little escape scenario and steal the guard's keys. And it'd be really cool. And suddenly it's an international freaking incident.
Well, and I think there's two things that figure into that. One is that I think many times game masters don't clearly communicate that failure does not have to equal death in their games.
Right.
If you look at the traditional way that most games are run,
and success does not necessarily mean winning a fight.
No, correct. I remember if you think back to the very classic D&D days, they described anyone you ran into as an encounter.
Right.
Talking to a shopkeeper was an encounter.
Killing the shopkeeper was... It is an encounter, but a totally different one.
Yeah. Was the successful outcome of the encounter was killing the shopkeeper.
Well, and I don't know if any of you guys remember this, but from the older editions of D&D, you got experience points for completing an encounter. And completing an encounter could include sneaking past, running away, bartering, parlaying. Mm-hmm. The only option was not to fight to the death. And I think a lot of game masters don't send a clear message as to what exactly the consequences at stake are here. Now, I get if you're talking about a game where you run into the mindless monster horde.
Oh, sure.
You're playing StarCraft Troopers and you run into the bugs.
Let's say a zombie game.
A zombie game. There is no surrender.
I surrender to the zombies.
The zombies don't take prisoners. I understand that in the same way in D&D, shambling mounds don't take prisoners. Okay, I get all that. And so sometimes that's not the case. But in many games and in many situations within those games, you are dealing with sapient creatures. And I think game masters need to kind of, as best as they can, send a message of surrender is acceptable. In the Battletech game that we played a year or two back, you know, it was very explicit in there, because I talked to you guys about the Ares Convention and what it allows and what rights you're afforded if you guys simply say, we quit. You know, you're allowed to leave with your mechs and your people and whatnot. That was explicitly stated. Now, in many games, it's not so explicitly stated, but you can have the bad guys say, look, there's 10 of us still standing. 3 of you are unconscious. One of you's bleeding out. And there's one of you with a handful of hit points left. Throw in the towel. And the players, if they have some trust for the GM, will understand that that's a viable option. Yes, there's going to be consequences. You've just been taken prisoner. That's not a good thing. It is a consequence, but there is a place for the story to go from here.
So my question is, though, you say, you know, the GM is not explaining up front about, you know, surrender is a viable option and not necessarily the end of the game. How do you, though, really go about doing that? And I ask, it may seem like an obvious question, but let me give you an example. In one of my campaigns I ran, I wrote out just a brief, like a half-page thing explaining how the laws of the land worked. And then I even, on top of that, I verbally explained to them, saying, if you're outside of such and such's border, you essentially become the law, you can pass judgment, you can do these kinds of things. And the players were so hardwired when they captured certain prisoners to bring them back to the authorities, they never embraced or even paid much attention to what I told them they could, as characters, do when it came to circumstances like that. So how do you then really go about convincing your players that it's okay to either allow yourself to be captured or to surrender? I mean, how do you really go and do that and have them get it?
I think I can give you a couple pieces of advice, but the punchline at the heart of them all, we talk a lot about game masters know your players. This is kind of the reverse thing. Players know your game master. Know what it is the game master is going to do or not do. Look, if it comes down to it, I don't think there's even necessarily harm in having the framework of a metagame conversation. And let me explain that pretty carefully, because I think that phrase might be prone to misinterpretation. Let's say Chad's running a game. And
is it Shadowrun?
Yes, it is Shadowrun.
You bastard.
A Shadowrun has gone horribly awry.
Not surprising. No.
And my cyborg elf is the only character last stand.
Did I just vomit all over your character sheet?
Yeah. Okay. All right, but no, I'll search. Let's say Chad's running a game. And there comes a point where the party's beat to crap. Chad's saying, you know, the leader of the bad guys is like, throw down your weapons and surrender. Now, at this point, I don't think I can reasonably ask of Chad, I want you to tell me what this guy is going to do to me, everything he has in mind, what he's morally capable of, whether I'll be put up for execution. Because I think to ask any of those things is effectively to say, I want all kinds of metagame knowledge so I can decide what to do in character. And I think that's game breaking because of the fact that I might as well just have you tell me the rest of the story. You know, I think it's an unfair request, but I think I can at that point stop and ask Chad, if I surrender, is there a future here?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to know what it is, but it's just, look, Dan to Chad, okay? I realize the consistency of the game says I should not know anything. This guy could say, throw down your weapons, and the very next thing he does, as soon as I throw my weapons down, is they charge and they finish and they wipe us out. I get that. And if consistency of that type is important to your games, then this advice will not work because it's not the kind of game that you want to run. But for our type of game, where our primary goal is above all else to tell a story that everyone is enjoying, if I look at Chad and say, look, I'm not expecting you to tell me every detail, but I need to know as a player.
I think it's fair for you to look at me and say, in that situation, say, hey, I've got a concern. Did we just screw the pooch here?
Yeah, did we screw the pooch?
If I could say, no, keep going with it. This is good.
Yeah, if I surrender, is it going to be a TPK? Yeah. Does it end the story? And you don't have to tell me everything about what this guy plans, what he intends to do with us, why he would rather have us alive. Will we maybe be taken back to camp, given a kangaroo court trial, and within 24 hours, our heads are on the block? You know, I don't think I need to ask all of that, but I think it is fair to stop and have a metagame conversation, a very, very high level one, of just saying, help me understand what I can get away with here. Because I think some of the reason that players continue to fight is because they have the sense that if they lose, they will die. That is the only possible outcome of the situation, that to lose is to die. And sometimes that's the case. Look, I get it. There are certain enemies that don't take prisoners. Zombies is a great example.
So but, I have another concern as a player at that point. Maybe this comes off as a little bit shallow. Maybe it's not something other people run into as well. I look at my character sheet, and if I have interesting things on there, like gear and stuff, I have the fear of, okay, I'm going to be taken prisoner. I'm not worried about my character dying because I know the GMs I'm playing with.
Don't take my stuff.
That's really it. And if there's an escape plan, I think about if we escape right now like this, let's say I have this magical sword that has this good backstory, that's over there in a locked box somewhere. You know, and if I escape, I'm going to be losing that part of my character.
I'm of two minds on this. Actually, kind of three minds. One, did you pay points in character creation to get this item? Then I think it can be taken away from you temporarily, but it must be given back. You bought that. You sacrificed things to get that. You know, but I think it can be taken away and given back.
Or
but,
is it a part of your character class?
Right.
For example, like
your class doesn't function without it. It's like, I think on the other hand, is it unique and does it have a good backstory? Did you sacrifice in game to get it? And basically, if I take this away permanently, is that a real dick move? Absolutely, it's a dick move. Then don't take it away. If you have Joe Generic Sword that every single soldier in the realm has, and you've got 10 back at camp, and I take that one away from you, and you're whining that you can never get Joe Generic Sword back, and I only have 9 now instead of 10. I'm like, come on.
Yeah, and I think you know me well enough to know that wouldn't be the kind of thing I'd be worrying about.
I've played with people who did. I mean, their gear list could never be removed from them.
Yeah. It's the first class of thing for me. Usually my characters almost always on their character sheet have at least one sentimental item of some sort with a history.
Sure.
And then occasionally it'll be playing a game where something is an intricate part of that,
but
the mechanics of that character.
These are the types of people, though, who, and it's nobody here, but these are the types of people who, like, they're encased in full plate mail armor and they never take it off, and they go into the tavern chunk 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 in their armor, and then they go to sleep in their armor. I could see Pat in his Jane Eyre role-playing game, you know, in your full plate mail armor, to the tea party with smashing crumpets against the closed faceplate of your plate mail armor.
That's a serious concern for me as a player, though, is if I get captured.
Pat pushing scones through his faceplate?
Yes, it is. Well, it should be. I'm glad that he's concerned about that.
But I mean, if I get captured, I have that serious concern that may happen. May not even be something that the GM wants to see happen. It's just, okay, we were captured, we're in a cell, we come up with our own escape plan, and the GM has this brilliant plan for how we were going to escape, and we came up with something else, and we now leave without our stuff.
Okay, yeah, let me go back to that. If the game master has figured out exactly how escape will occur, I think that's no worse than railroading any other part of the game. Yeah,
that's
now,
true.
I think the game master should certainly have opportunities. Or if the party is stuck, like they're just not catching on to your hints or what it is they do, they don't.
Maybe they never watched The Great Escape or Escape from Alcatraz.
Or maybe
and they just
they're
don't
just
get
not
the concept.
Familiar with the setting and don't know how things work. And
how the hell do you escape from a Star Trek force field prison when you
precisely.
Don't have any superpowers?
And so, I can tell you.
So maybe there have to be some opportunities that are kind of dangled in front of you. But I think if I was to say, well, this is how you're going to escape, then I don't know that that's really a good way to write that plot. You know, and kind of backing up a point, I think another situation where the loss of gear can be interesting without being absolutely destructive is a survival game.
Mm-hmm.
Something like Skies of Glass. You know, if you lose a couple days of food and a spear, those things can be replaced, but
that's life and death.
That's
a different genre.
And that's now a very different kind of struggle.
I really liked how you did the capture in your Skies of Glass game. The motivations for the character surrender tied in mechanics of the game and their personalities and their backstories and playing IC-ness, because their personalities dictated that they were young kids. When I say young, they were like teenagers. And they were in the whole point of the game was that they were in way over their head.
Yeah. And when that went down, you guys were in, I say you guys, sans Chad, you actually managed to
get
away.
I was on the roof.
But most of the party was in the lower level of a relatively small brick building surrounded by a large number of cavalrymen with rifles.
Yeah, heavily armed men who were combat veterans.
And I don't mean like hundreds, but I mean there were...
Well, there were like four of us and 15 of them.
Yeah, there's like two or three dozen of them.
It was lethal odds. That's the thing. And that's the thing. Like in that case, there was absolutely no question in my mind, we have to surrender.
Yeah.
And that's why I was particularly... I remember this. I was particularly perturbed with you because you were trying to escape. I thought you were going to get us all killed right then and there.
I was trying to play the escape plan.
Holy crap, Chad's going to... He's going to go off and they're just going to shoot every one of us because he's pulling some, you know, cowboy maneuver here.
I kept trying to come up with escape plans at that point because I'd never been in this situation. So I thought when it came to these are armed guards around us, we're as good as dead if we surrender. I didn't realize it was an option at that point.
Yeah. Well,
I had idea it was an option.
I, in these cases, I'm always thinking in the moment itself, usually, because yes, we're surrounded by superior odds. They're better armed than we are. We don't really have a choice. I mean, we ain't running. We do. They're just going to gun us down.
Bullet runs faster.
Wayne, let me ask you a question here. And these are rhetorical questions, but these are the types of questions I think a player should ask of their game master internally. And if you don't know the answer, then ask them externally. Is the game master really out to kill the party? Is the game master hell-bent on that kind of brutal odds and consequences? And maybe your group is. And if so, then that's fine. That's the type of game you're playing. But you know that going into that. You know whether surrender is an option or not. The second thing is if you'd said surrender is an option, the next thing you've got to ask yourself is, does the game master really want to run, we sit in a cell and read magazines all day, the role-playing game? You have to presuppose there's a story on the other side of that. Now, I want to move from this because I think we got caught up maybe in a disclaimer a little longer than I wanted to. But in addition to captivity offering a punishment apart from the total party kill, for anyone who's not familiar with what TPK stands for, here's something else it offers. Captivity offers you the opportunity to see the bad guys firsthand. One of the questions that I have seen pop up in my email box or on the forums fairly often is people say, I've put a lot of detail into my NPCs, my antagonists specifically, the bad guys. And I want my players to have a sense of who these people are and what they want and how they operate, and to maybe even get a feel for the depth of personality that's there, or maybe even the moral grayness or the arguability of their cause. And I think there are many ways you can do this. It's possible, for example, that the antagonist may earlier in the game either actually be or at least have the appearance of being a friend. It's possible that you may interact with the person on neutral grounds. But I think one of the opportunities that you can have during the course of a game to see the bad guys firsthand is to be in their captivity. Because now all of a sudden, you get to see what their culture's like. You get to see how they interact. I am not suggesting doing some cheesy James Bond thing where the villain comes in and does plot exposition on everything they intend to do. I'm not suggesting that. But I'm saying you as a game master can drop hints, especially...
I don't want you to talk, Mr. Bond. I want you to die.
But especially once the party's escaping, because once you get to that point of the story, well, the party's now in control. If they stumble across a data file on their way out of the prison ship, well, they've just gotten something that's maybe going to tell them a little bit more about what's going on. While they're getting...
Unless it's a file on Data's cat poetry.
In which case, it sounds great when it's set to the last episode.
It is.
I'll look at the show for anyone who's never heard that. But...
Pat shaking his head. Just go back to your Jane Eyre full play fantasy. Yes.
This is an opportunity, nonetheless, to kind of pull back what life is like amongst these particular individuals. For example.
Oh, so that Skies of Glass woman is a perfect example of this.
Oh, yeah. Because you guys got to talk to Mark Harver.
We got to talk to the leader. We got to
kill her.
Yeah, we got to be paraded through their town. So we saw how they live. We got thrown into a pen where we talked to other prisoners. And we got to just throughout the day watch what was happening in the town, just what they do on a day-to-day basis. And no one would have had a chance to see that.
Homebrew sci-fi game I'm running right now. One of the first plot lines you guys went through, you weren't per se captives technically, but you guys were stuck on an alien ship with an alien race, not under the best of terms. I mean, you weren't captured in the sense that you weren't locked in a cell. They intended to release you when it was over, but there was clearly an element of this is not where you guys would want to be. But one of the things that I got to do as a game master was I'm taking people who are largely unfamiliar with the setting, who are largely unfamiliar with the Salian race, and you guys suddenly get to see this is how they exist. This is what their culture's like. This is how they interact with each other. This is what the strata of their society looks like. This is how they organize themselves. And so it was an opportunity, you know, that old phrase of show, don't tell. I got an opportunity to show you what these creatures are like, even though I never once stopped and did a huge amount of exposition, except for the few cases where either A, you guys directly asked them a question about their culture, or B, one of them told you something about their culture, knowing you needed that bit of information to understand what was going on.
Like they poop out of their feet.
Yes. For example, you learn they poop out of their feet.
As a GM, I know I've always avoided captivity if I possibly can. And I do this for a couple reasons that I'm kind of curious how you guys deal with it when you've done it. First thing is, I am afraid of presenting a situation that my players feel is hopeless. Because I never want to get into that position where the players are captured and they can't see a way out.
Yes.
The thing that I worry about is, if their escape plan is bad and they botch it, how am I going to believably, with internal consistency, not lead to the players being killed in the process?
Okay, let me tackle those separately. This is even a line in my notes right here. The potential player frustration of being powerless and trapped. Various solutions such as making the captivity interesting and doing lots of RP. Wayne, you are absolutely right. To be captured can be a very, very crappy experience because of the fact that depending on how it's conducted and what the circumstances are, you're sitting and rotting in a cell while nothing happens. And if a game master is doing that, maybe that does fit the situation. Maybe there is a time and place for that. But I think the game master is missing an opportunity. Because for a moment, even if you forget about the antagonist, even if Baron Von Badass is not going to come in and give you any sense of his motivation or culture or personality, look, when you're in a town, I think it's incumbent upon the game master to make the townspeople more than cardboard cutouts. Why can't you be sharing a cell with a crazy guy or a revolutionary idealist or a genuine criminal who really did something to deserve to end up being there? Because, of course, the party certainly isn't genuine criminals, right? Always law-abiding citizens.
Right.
But the point being that I think the game master can give that scene content to where the fact that you're powerless and trapped is not the central emotion of the event. Now, I think it should be part of it. I mean, it should be. You're locked in a damn cell. You are captured. Whether you're chained to a tree or in a brig or whatever, that powerlessness and that sense of being trapped, it's an inescapable, excuse the pun, part of the scene. But if that's all the game master has put in there, then I would say that the game master has done just as poor of a job with that incarceration as they have if you walk into the town and you have shopkeeper and bartender and all these other equally vacuous and vapid role-based characters.
I think it's also it's a missed opportunity for the players. I mean, yes, they can be captured and they can be stuck there every day, but there's more than enough that the players can do without their equipment and just taking advantage of that captivity.
Don't take their stuff. They hate you when you take their stuff.
Wayne, to answer your other question.
I'm nothing without my gear.
No.
Wayne, to answer your other question about what happens if the escape goes wrong, I don't know that I necessarily have a good answer for that. And I'm curious to hear if you guys either are on the show or if not on the show, people on the forums do. I'll give you kind of a few thoughts off the top of my head on how I think I would handle it. The game master has the advantage of hearing what the party is planning.
Right.
And if necessary, if my desire is to get you guys out of that prison.
Unless we put you in the corner.
Which is, there have been times where I've done double blind.
We have put you in the naughty corner.
Yeah, there have been times I've done the double blind because the party said, look, we want to plan something in secret and really kind of surprise you with it. And I've agreed, that's fine. I'll go into another room until you guys are done, and then I'll come back and we'll play this in a true double blind.
I have a picture of you in the naughty corner, too.
But if I am sitting there while the party is planning their escape, there's several opportunities I've got here. If there's an NPC in the cell with you, he or she might give you some guidance on good and bad ideas or things they noticed. I can choose to reveal things like you notice a changing of the guards. You notice one guard tends to doze off. You notice there's one that's kind of prone to bribery. You're in a war that between the East versus the West, and you happen to notice that the guy that's guarding your cell looks like he's from your area. And so maybe he's going to be a little bit more sympathetic to your cause. I think there are ways I can drop hints to help your plan. And if I hear holes in your plan, but I know what they are, I can work around those to help make them a little more plausible. It's like, okay, this is a really bad idea to attempt to knock out the guard and run out the front gate. But you know what? I can have things occur like there's a prison riot. There's an inspection that has pulled the guards away from the main gate. I can find some way to try and make it more plausible. Now, at the end of the day, if you just botch it so hideously and horribly that I cannot justify them even attempting to recapture you, it has come down to a run-and-gun battle, then maybe at that point, I really have to start asking some hard questions. Let's go back to the episode on forced success. Yeah. Maybe I have to start asking the hard questions of either, A, I've got to break internal consistency, or I've got to break skulls.
Yeah, the plan requires, say, hacking a security camera, and you roll a one. I mean, that's part of the thing that comes in is the mechanical aspect of it too. Maybe the plan is a brilliant plan and it should have worked and everything was lined up and then bad roll, bad roll, bad roll, bad roll.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of thing that is prone to happen.
Not all rolls succeed. I mean, that's why there is randomness mm-hmm. to it.
Yeah.
And not everything that needs to happen requires a roll.
That's true too.
Here's something else where I think you can kind of use history as a guide. If you want to come up with some ways that a party can believably escape, and you want to look at the mistakes that can be made by the captors or the opportunities that can be presented to the captives, start looking through history. Look up some of the great escapes of World War II. Look up some of the great prison breakouts that have occurred throughout history.
There's a good movie called Colditz, which is about a World War II escaping a Colditz prison. The Great Escape is really good. Escape from Alcatraz, which is a Clint Eastwood movie.
Even Shawshank Redemption.
Shawshank Redemption, excellent movie.
Yeah, and that's a movie about mm-hmm. escaping from a prison.
Well, and the good thing about Shawshank Redemption is that it shows that there are other stories in prison. I mean, what's wrong with, you know, you have a story and instead of just one session, the guys get captured and then they break out and punch the jailer in the face and then ride off with not only their stuff, but the jailer's stuff, too. What's wrong with having a story arc that takes place in prison?
Yeah, and that's what I was getting at earlier.
Because there's so many good stories that can be told in prison.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I was getting at earlier in talking about the opportunities for role play and depth that can mm-hmm. occur within captivity. I absolutely agree with you, Chad, that if a game master looks at a game and says, you know what? There is this course of the game. Okay, so let's just say we draw a straight line. This represents the path of the game. And I'm not implying it's railroady, but let's just say that this implies the general direction the game is supposed to take. And to a lot of people, and I think myself included, this is something I've had to work to break in my own mentality, is captivity is getting pulled off of that line.
Mm-hmm.
And the only purpose of captivity is at least the party is still alive, and my only goal is for you guys to get out of there so you can get back on that line.
Right.
That, I think, is throwing away a lot of opportunity to tell, as you said, these great stories that either A, may tie into the main plot. Mm-hmm. You reveal more about the bad guy, their culture, the other groups that are resisting them. I mean, if you're in a political prison, who else is in there? What did they do? But on top of that, you know, hey, maybe it's the Baron von Badass's brother who he's thrown in prison in an iron mask to keep him from usurping him.
Mm-hmm.
Alphonse von Badass.
But I think in the same way, you can tell these great isolated side stories that may or may not even ever tie back to the main story about these episodes that people went mm-hmm. through while they're in prison. And this is where I don't think we can exhaustively cover this on the show, but I really encourage people, just Google things like great escapes from prisoner
escape
war
from
camps.
Sobibor.
Yeah.
God, that a true story, and it's a great movie.
And look some of these things up. And that's another thing is, you know, look, Wayne, you said, how does the party break out? Maybe the party doesn't break out. Maybe they get broken out. You know, maybe somebody else comes. I mean, maybe you're in a situation where the party has no allies, but maybe you're in a situation where eventually the townsfolk or the people on your side or whoever it is that hired you to do the job and doesn't want to lose their investment or doesn't want to risk you talking, whatever the case is, maybe you get broken out.
Yeah.
That's a good point that, honestly, I get so caught when GMing in that mindset of the players have to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I give the NPCs that are on the player's side enough power, ability, or skill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that you run into two problems. One is that game masters tend to present it poorly. We're just walking along, we're the PCs, and suddenly we're descended upon by forces that we cannot possibly comprehend, that are, we don't know why they're grabbing us, and we cannot possibly do anything about it, and we get stuck on the rails. PCs, on the other hand, tend to get into this thing of, if I get captured, I have lost, and I cannot lose. And if I get captured, all my stuff is going to get taken away, and that makes my character lesser. And lesser is losing.
And to lose is to say my character failed, and to fail. And I'm once again, this is not true for everyone.
No, it's not.
I think for a lot of people, it's a hit to the ego.
Yeah, it is.
My character wasn't badass enough.
Yeah.
I would rather go down and die than be taken. And you know what? If that is your character's personality, mm-hmm. that he's that sort of person or she's that sort of person where they would sooner die than be captured, that's fine. That's a role-playing choice. Where I am kind of rejecting this is when it's not an in-character choice. Right. It's an out-of-character ego.
Yeah. You get the PCs, okay, you've got them in prison, and they're fine with it. They're cool. There's no problem. Instead of playing the long game, the PCs want to punch their buttons. They want to pick the lock, and they want to sneak past the guard, and then they want to use their bluff check on another guard, and then they want to do the, you know, and it's just like, do, and they're trying to get out that door as fast as possible. You know, hey, great effort, but explore your environment a little. See what's going
that's
on.
That's one of the fascinating things about prison escapes, whether we're talking about war camps mm-hmm. or more traditional jails and prisons. There is a difference between jail and prison, by the way, for anyone who was not aware.
you throw drunks in jail. When the drunks kill somebody, they go to prison.
Prison, yeah. Eminem teaches you, it's a place called prison, a place called jail, a place called heaven, and a place called hell. And daddy's going to three of the four. The point being, though, if you look at these stories, in some cases, yes, the people did escape very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, for the sake of your plot, you may not want the players to be there or the characters to be there for a long period of time. But if you look at other of these stories, in many cases, it took weeks, months, even years mm-hmm. for these people to break out. There's a show, and I don't know if it's still on or not, but there's a show that was on one of the History A&E, one of those channels.
History of Modern Warfare channels.
Called I Almost Got Away With It.
Mm.
And it's about people that committed these very atrocious crimes and almost got away with it. And in many cases, that story includes at one point they were locked up and they got out. And one of the stories that kind of sticks out in my mind is there was this one guy, and I don't remember what he was accused of doing. I think it was killing somebody. It wasn't anything good, obviously. But they locked him up in jail, because I think he was awaiting trial. So it was jail, not prison. And he decided he wanted to escape. He started noticing that there were cinder blocks his wall was made out of. And between the cinder blocks, obviously, was a mortar that held them together. And they were all painted that kind of, you know, kind of sterile, sort of weird greenish color that schools and government buildings would not tend to be painted out of, at least around here. That they were made of that color. And what he did was he spent quite some time playing various board games like checkers and chess against the other inmates. And since they didn't have much of anything else to play with, they were gambling Jolly Ranchers. Okay. And what this guy was doing was he was telling everyone that he only liked two flavors, blue raspberry and green apple. And what he was actually doing was he had figured out how to take those to grind them up into a powder and to create a paste using the right mixture of those colors to imitate the color of the wall. And over the course of a very long period of time, was cutting away at portions of the wall and was, you know, working that stuff off. And then whenever he felt inspection was close or he was about to get observed, he'd mix up a batch of that paste and effectively repaint that portion of the wall. And had met. Now, this was not a short process. This was a process that took a while. It was kind of funny is at the end of the day, that's not even how he escaped. How he escaped was he built enough relationships with the other prisoners to where, you know, it's a don't snitch sort of culture. He figured out the culture of the prison. He didn't figure out the culture of his captors. He figured out the culture of his fellow inmates. it's a big don't snitch thing in prison. And so what he finally ended up doing was he figured out a way to put together a bunch of, I don't remember what it was, like rolled up magazines that he'd figure out how somehow to kind of roll up an interlock. And he basically waited until the guards were a little bit distracted. And he just told the other prisoners, hey, just don't watch. He took this thing out, assembled this contraption, was able to reach up, hook it over some of the barbed wire to pull it down, and climbed his way out. These are all fascinating stories. The board games he's playing, the plans he's coming up with, why he eventually abandoned one plan and went with another, the things he learned about prison culture to make this work. These are fascinating stories. And I can't even remember what his crime was.
Right.
I also don't remember entirely how he got re-caught. I think, as best as I remember the story, once he was out in the woods, he ended up being encircled and captured, I think. I don't even remember for sure. But the point is, this is where our story stuck out to me. If all you can tell in the story of people being locked up in prison is, yeah, you're stuck here, your only goal is to get out as quickly as you can to get back on the plot rails, then you as a game master, once again, I think you have dropped the ball in terms of setting a really compelling world.
I think that it's important, though, like you said, the players need to know the game master in that, like Wayne said, I know Dan's not going to kill the characters because he said he's not. And so there's something more to this whole thing, and we just need to figure out what it is. I think that the game master needs to figure out the players, too, and needs to know them. And either to be able to communicate to them, it's like, hey, guys, we're doing the prison break thing, or, hey, it's okay to get captured, or, hey, you know, I'm sending some cops around to arrest you. If you kill them, more cops will come. And if you kill them, the National Guard's going to come.
Yeah, and this was something that even in that game where, you know, we talked about forcing success, that I fell back to was when it was at a certain level, it's like, okay, maybe I can kind of let you guys off the hook. But at one point, Dawn was talking about how she was going to cut off certain systems on the space station and bring it into a decaying orbit. I'm like, time out. That's an act of war. You do this. There is no turning back. It's not cops. It's going to be the military coming after you guys. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to be coming with handcuffs. And at that point, you know, she got the hint and backed off from it. Now, once again, I recognize there's some game masters out there and some players out there who would say, I don't want that in my game. That sense of that unknown, the sense of the consequence I can't control, the sense of a world that has internal consistency, where sometimes the bad guy tells you to lay down your arms, and as soon as you do, he says, suckers, and then kills you all. And that's the game they want. And I get that. I totally get that. And if that's the game you want, then you know what? I don't think there's a whole lot of advice that you even need about this because of the fact that the unknown and the consequence, that's the compelling part of the story to you. But for people that are more like us, where it's not per se that the story is about success or failure, but it's more a matter of the party doesn't want to A, be bored, or B, be constantly kicked puppies, that you can look at this as an opportunity to do so much, provided that the trust that we always talk about goes the other direction, and the players trust the game master, and the game master really uses that prison or that incarceration, whatever form it takes, as an opportunity to grow the world rather than to simply put a speed bump in front of the players.
You know how I got my players to go in, to get into prison? I got them to voluntarily go.
Advertised free butt sex?
No, I put the plot in there. I butt sex aside, I put the plot in there to where it's like, okay, you guys have a choice. You can either break in or you can become prisoners. You know, you can throw the brick through the window or do whatever you need to do and surrender to the authorities and become the prisoners and then break out.
You know, it's kind of funny.
And they did. I thought it worked out pretty well. We never finished the game, but
we started this on a Shadowrun anecdote. So it's in this episode on a Shadowrun anecdote.
Bookends of crap.
Do you realize in all the years of me running Shadowrun games, which I haven't been recently, but throughout the early and mid parts of my gaming career, I ran a lot of Shadowrun. I have never run a campaign of Shadowrun that did not include the following two things. One, an attempted bank robbery that went horribly awry, which ended with everyone in a Lone Star jail.
Always fun.
And Chad, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
How many bank robberies did you guys attempt in I don't know how many different campaigns?
Like, why are there even banks?
And every one of them ends with you guys in a Lone Star prison.
I think we got out of the one because I remember my vampire rigger character jumping into his car and driving out. It was,
Yeah.
With his legs hanging out the window. You know, he jumped in Dukes of Hazzard style. And
nice.
Yeah, it was quality gaming.
Yeah, I'm not saying this was the pinnacle of gaming.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it occurred.
Oh, yeah.
So, anyway, check the show notes. I don't know what I'll have links to. Certainly, if you're the con, some of the rest of the stuff I'll have to
do. I'll try and get Dan's naughty picture.
Yeah, if I can get, well, or I can link it to, even directly off of Facebook, but they'll have to have you as a friend on Facebook in order to see that.
Many booters do.
Yeah, same thing here. Many booters do, but yeah, if you send us a friend invite on Facebook as individuals, there's a Fear the Boot group on Facebook. There's also one on Google+. But if you send us invites personally, we, as far as I know, typically accept them. Mm-hmm. I don't know if every host does, but I do.
Yeah.
So anyway, check the show notes, see what's out there. Get out there for Fear the Con 6. Beyond that, as always, have a great week and even better games. And we will catch you guys next time.
Stay out of jail.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2013. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.